Hey guys, it's me, the comeback coach, Richard Kaufman. I am known as the junkie who just got lucky. I went from dope dealer to hope dealer, and now I'm honored to be able to be part of your journey, and thank you for being part of mine. Guys, this is going to be a great episode. Guys, raise your hand if you struggle with anxiety, depression, and sleeplessness. Me too. So we're going to be talking about that because my friend has an amazing app he created, and we talked about almost 2 months ago. I wanted to actually use it before I had him on it, and now I will not go a day without using it. I use it every single day. So we're going to be talking about that. First, I want to thank our sponsors real quick. Soldier Girl Coffee. If you guys love coffee with a little bit of CBD in it to help you get a little bit focused and chillax, definitely check out Soldier Girl Coffee. And also my book, A Hero's Journey from Darkness to Light, helps people struggling with PTSD, depression. And if you pick it up, I'm going to give you a special bonus worth $997. All for 11 bucks. So if you pick up my book, expect bonuses of up to almost $1,000. So guys, this is going to be a great episode with my brother, Brandon. What's up, Brandon? What's going on?
Oh, Richard, great to be here. I'm pumped up after watching that intro video.
Yeah. My friend William did a great job on it, right?
Absolutely. Well, can he help me one day?
Yeah, definitely. So tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, where you grew up, and what kind of little kid was Brandon?
Little kid Brandon. Interestingly enough, my mom says that I was a really outgoing person. The kind of kid that would walk up to strangers, have a conversation, and you know, just hang out next to them. And my mom would have to like pull me away. But you know, my parents had graduated from Syracuse University. So I was born in Buffalo. Somehow my dad became an engineer. So somehow we wound up in South Carolina. And that's really where I grew up. And, you know, I was a kid who wanted to get perfect scores in elementary school, in kindergarten and first grade, because like the teacher would use the marker that smelled really good. So I really just wanted the scratch and sniff sticker and all that. But really, like within hours of landing in South Carolina, like my world had shifted. My family and I, we went to the grocery store. Somebody ran a shopping cart into us and was like, "Welcome to the South." We're like, "Okay, we're in the South." My first day of school, you know, all the kids are like trying to talk to me, like, "Who's the new kid?" And like, I'm just being nice, answering questions. And like, immediately the teacher's yelling at me, like, "I'm talking too much. And like, we don't do that down here." And, you know, it's always just been like this constant learning of what exactly is expected of me, like in this environment. So, you know, I grew up in the South. I navigated, you know, a decent amount of stress and all that. But I used basketball to sort of like help me find my place. And, you know, it was good for me. It was good to sort of like let out, you know, whatever sort of energy I had in a positive way. And, you know, that led me to, interestingly enough, like two college options, because I wanted to play basketball in college.
All right, wait, hold on. I'm a big basketball geek. I love basketball. And, you know, I grew up in New Jersey, but I became a man in South Carolina. And South Carolina now, Gamecocks, got a great basketball program. But back then, yeah, it was either UNC or Duke.
So, absolutely.
So what teams did you follow, and who were some of your favorite players?
Sure. So, you know, I think my first basketball player were like Syracuse guys. The name like Lawrence Moten rings a bell. It was a guy, Wallace, who was good for Syracuse. And then John Wallace. Yeah, he was like my first basketball hero. And then I was like, you know, then it was everybody was talking about, you know, Michael Jordan. But when it came to college basketball, I remember really liking Duke until it was this one game where I was just convinced that they had all just like the whole team had just fell off. And I thought they were like throwing the game on purpose. So I kind of got mad at Duke that day. And I became a little bit more devoted to the Tar Heels. I mean, like Rasheed Wallace, you know, Vince Carter was like, you know, he was my hero. Like he became my hero once I saw him play in college. Once I saw that man fly, like I wanted to play like Vince. I didn't fly too high, but I will take credit for dunking on Kevin Garnett once upon a time.
You know, and I love KG, one of the most intense guys that you'll ever meet and talk. So what college offers did you get, and where did you pick and why?
Sure. I wanted to mention also, part of that stint before I got to South Carolina, I was in New Jersey until about the middle of first grade. But yeah, on the basketball front, I was, you know, I think I was like, you know, top 10 in my state. I wasn't like, you know, top five. I don't know if I made top 100 in the country. I went to a couple of those basketball camps. I was getting offers to like walk on at Syracuse and Duke. But my scholarship offers came more so from College of Charleston, the Naval Academy, and Brown University. And so College of Charleston wanted me to sign early, and I didn't feel like being rushed. Like they said, come visit. I'm like, all right, I'll come visit. And they're like, sign this paper. I'm like, no. The Naval Academy was similar in that, and this might be a good topic for conversation, but you know, I didn't really have a lot of fun on my trip. I understood like I was about to walk into an environment that was going to be incredibly rigid with rules. And I did enjoy discipline. Like discipline encouraged me to like, you know, work hard, stay focused, get good grades and perform well in sports. But it's like, I didn't feel like I wanted more discipline. and so I was like kind of on the fence if I would go there. Plus the coach there told me that I was going to be on the junior varsity team. And I had started as a freshman in high school, so my ego was not going to let me go play junior varsity. So,
how tall were you?
How tall? I was the same height I am now. I was 6'5", my junior year of high school.
Because, you know, a lot of people would think if you're going to, you know, a lot of basketball players think, you know, if you're going to go to the Naval Academy, you know, the Admiral David Robinson, you know, he's like 7 foot.
Yeah. So,
you know, those are like big shoes to fill. But then there's really like no other names that really ever came out of the Naval Academy that most people would know. So if you're not a center and 7 foot, I'd be like, why am I going to go? You know what I mean?
Well, that was the thing. Like he went to the Naval Academy at like 6'5", and then he grew like 6-7 inches while he was there. And so they were asking me like, are you going to grow 7 inches? Like, I hope so, but like, I can't make any promises.
Yeah.
And I was like, sir, yes, sir, I will grow 7 inches. Give me a scholarship. Let's see what happens.
Did you get a scholarship? Did they offer it?
They offered it. I just didn't want to play junior varsity or go through a lot of that, you know, military, you know, plebe stuff that they were like sort of intimidating me with. Like freshmen have to do this, that, and the other. I'm just like, let's see if this is my best option. So then I went to Brown like a couple weeks later, and it was Halloween. And they were just having a blast. I had a blast. It was just fun. And I was like, all right, so this is an Ivy League school where kids have fun and they want me to come here. It was like, I had a lot of whispers from family and friends saying like, if you can get into the Ivies, you can get into the Ivies. So I went there. However, the Naval Academy looked at me funny. It's like, are you sure you want to turn down the Naval Academy? Like, I didn't understand how much influence the Naval Academy had, like how much influence they could have on my future, at the world's future. And you know, that might have been my oversight. I don't know if I still was built for the Naval Academy, like with everything that would have had to go down. I think I would have changed a lot, would have had to change a lot. And so either way, life happens the way it happens, and I wound up playing basketball at Brown. You know, we played against some tough competition. We played against UConn back in the day, and Boston College, Providence College. I had a lot of fun. We had some good experiences, but you know, it was also kind of broke me a little bit. College was really competitive, and these kids were really way smarter than I was. And the basketball players were better than I was. So it was a lot of like trying to keep up and rise to the top. But I had one of those coaches who was, you know, Bobby Knight reincarnated, or Bobby Knight may have been his inspiration. Cause you know, at first he was a strict guy, and then as soon as the games happened, it was a lot of like stomping and yelling and cursing and berating and just like, you know, just embarrassing people for the sake of like, I don't know if he thought that worked for him or if that worked for everybody, but it just didn't work for me. And so my college experience was like almost sacrificial for me. I kind of just had to like swallow a lot of pride, you know, understand sort of how I could help the team most. And outside of being, you know, a good defender and somebody who cares, you know, I kind of became like the team scapegoat. Like,
you know, we're going to talk a little bit about leadership.
Yeah.
And I've had a bunch of guys on the show and a lot of college coaches I've actually interviewed and had on the show, especially basketball. And they say, you know, that the best coaches are the guys, they want you on the team, but they also want to mentor you and also teach you how to become a man. And I think one of the best things that Coach K does is that he teaches you, you know, he makes you like a father figure almost in a way, you know what I mean? And so I'm sure, like you said, when this guy's sitting there throwing chairs like Bobby Knight, you don't want that kind of father figure, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't completely know what I was getting into. I mean, I was fortunate, and I think it's another massive topic that, you know, I was fortunate enough for my dad to be around and to give me an example of a father figure. But yeah, as far as basketball went, like this, people will call up our coach, like when he would do interviews on radio shows or whatever, and they would ask him, like, why aren't you playing Brandon Howard more? And he would like take off the mic and just like walk out. Like, he'd be so furious that anybody would mention my name. So I don't know if I rubbed him the wrong way, but you know, that was the experience. And you know, there's like, you know, trauma and drama there, and you know, just like the mental hurdles you go through to, like, you know, when you're as an athlete and maybe as an American, who knows, but when you spend your whole life living like, or sort of like pushing yourself for other people's approval, then when you don't get that approval, no matter how hard you work, you know, that was a little bit eye-opening. Like, it wasn't eye-opening to me at the time, but like looking back now and sort of like the things that lead to mental health issues, the things that lead to insomnia and depression and anxiety, it starts with, you know, the environments that we're in and who has the skills to, or the resources to understand how to navigate like a hostile environment, or to like, and I think some people are just naturally built to just let things roll off their shoulders or not take in other people's negative energy. I found myself to be, you know, significantly empathetic. and so, yeah, I didn't really know how to handle it. You know, my body broke down, then my mind broke down. And then I couldn't even play my senior year. I just kind of had to call it quits because I wasn't enjoying anything. I was in so much.
You know, take us back, because I want people to really get this. You know, at a point, like you said, you were top 10 in your state, one of the most cared about basketball players. And now you're in college and you're not even one of the most 10 cared about players on your team.
Yeah.
You know, because of the coach. I'm not talking about the other people. So what was that like when you know, after practice, you're like, oh man, I love my team. You know, I love that, but I know I'm not going to get playing time. And then after a game, after all the hoopla, and you're back in your room and you just feel like you feel defeated. What was that like sitting in that room?
Well, going back to like how I felt back then, like, confusion was probably the biggest part of it. You know, I loved basketball from my perspective, and you know, I went to practice and I left it all on the court every practice, and I would leave it on the court for every game. But when I wasn't sort of reaching my coach's expectations, just based off of the things he would say to me, you know, there's two directions you can go. And the direction that I chose was to just sort of keep thinking about, you know, am I doing the right thing? And that was getting in the way of being a good basketball player. I think what I notice about Coach K's guys is that the right thing becomes instinctual. And that's kind of why I bring it into the mental health realm. Like, if you do the right thing and sort of recognize sort of what is the right thing to do in that moment, like, you know, you hear Mark Jackson on NBA games, hands down, man down. Like, to see somebody's hands down on defense, you just know that the jump shot's open. But, you know, I would think about these things. And like, as I'm playing, I'm like, do I do this? Do I do that? Do I make the right pass? And when you see players thinking instead of playing, then they're lost. So that was my college experience. And what I realized far too late, you know, more recently, in the last couple of years, was, you know, you've got to let love drive you. The people who let love drive all their passions and everything that they do, they seem to be the most successful people. You listen to Kobe Bryant, like, you know, he was
Mamba. Mamba, yeah.
Absolutely. In high school, he felt a little outcasted just being like in from Italy, like new to Philly. And so he fell in love with basketball. Allen Iverson for me is like one of the best stories for like how it doesn't matter how big you are or how strong you are. Like he loved the game almost more than anybody. And I think that's how he got up from every injury. You know, there was a commercial. I only saw it once, but it listed like the 50 injuries and ailments and broken bones that Allen Iverson had. And not a single one of them slowed him down because he loved basketball more than I think anybody else I've seen play the game. But Steph Curry's also there too.
Then I got a question to ask you. Like you said, because I could just geek out talking ball all day.
I just
watched an interview with with Allen Iverson. He said, the reason I don't have the 5 rings that Kobe does, because Kobe put in the work. He said, I love the games, but I didn't want to put in the work. You know, like Kobe would get to practice 3 hours early, stay three hours late, just because he knew that his opponents were watching him. So talk about your experience. There's talent. You know, they say that hard work beats talent that doesn't work hard. So
yeah,
talk about
100%.
Between Allen Iverson, no rings, bankrupt, Kobe, 5 rings, Hall of Famer, probably had much more to do with his life. Can you talk about the different mindsets?
Yeah, I'm still reading, you know, the Mamba Mindset, Kobe's book.
Yep.
I'm still reading it, and what I am learning is exactly that. And it didn't take long to sort of see, you know, how passionate he was and how obvious his passion was. And I mean, we all look back to Iverson's like interviews, like we're talking about practice, not a game, practice. Like
talking about like,
practice. Exactly. That is a spectrum of effort. And that was what I recognized that I didn't have. I didn't have that love for the game or the recognition for what it took to get at the level that my teammates got to. You know, there were a couple of guys on the team who had keys to the gym. And instead of like saying like, ooh, can I go play with you or go practice with you? I was just a little bitter that like, why didn't I get the keys to the gym? And so, you know, I didn't have the awareness of how to sort of, you know, it's like if you're thinking about like, oh, I should go to the gym, like you're forcing yourself to go. It's like you're forcing yourself to do something that you might not love as much as you think you love it. And so Iverson clearly loved it even more than I did. But not enough to ensure, like, to have that mentality of, like, knowing the full sort of spectrum of the arena. Kobe wasn't playing against, you know, just the team he was, you know, up against. He was playing against history. He was playing up against Jordan. Even when Jordan wasn't on the court, he was playing against fans and their doubts. He was playing against his own doubts. He had a much broader picture of the game. And, you know, thinking on that level, like he's comparing himself. And when I played basketball, when I first started out, you know, it was always like, you know, what do I need to do? I get the ball, I score, I play D, I give help, et cetera. But like to have that perspective of knowing what's happening with every guy on the court, all 10 guys, like who's stressed out, who's tired, like who's weak, who's strong, like, and Kobe could manipulate. And the best players like Chris Paul, like he's looking for weaknesses in every moment of every play. And he finds them and he exploits them. And you don't do that just by knowing that you can do it. You have to like build that practice, build that reputation or build that experience. So your body knows what to do even before your brain has to analyze it. So that's why I see like Coach K and Kobe and Steph Curry, like they have so much passion for the game that it fills every thought that they have. Everything that they do is like, how to be a better basketball player, how to be a better coach. And I think some players are just like, this is fun, or I'm good at it, or this is something I should be good at, or this makes a lot of money. And I think that's how you lead to injuries. Because, you know, when you're having fun, you don't feel stress. When your perspective is in the right place, stress doesn't break your body down. It doesn't slow you down. It doesn't, you know, choke you at the free throw line when it matters. Like, so you've got to find that balance. And that's what the zone is. I mean, I want to help basketball players, get into the zone more automatically. Like, when do you imagine like 5 guys or 10 guys on the court all in the zone at the same time? Like, basketball would be that's another level.
Well, like, you know, I had a coach on, and we were talking. Now, he won a championship with girls championships with a girl basketball team. And he said, if I can get 5 women with one goal in mind, not worried about the name on the back of the jersey, but the name on the front of the jersey, he says they're unstoppable. So if you can, you know, even in business, if you can get your team all have the one purpose, one goal in mind, they're pretty much unstoppable. I mean, there's some teams back in the day, you know, if you look at the teams, like, well, I don't know how to turn into a whole basketball conversation, but, you know, if you look at the teams from the San Antonio Spurs, it was, you know, back with Manu and the big fundamental, you know, it was about team. Yeah. It wasn't about who can go for 30 tonight. You know, it was just about, all right, we win the game and we go home. Yeah. You know, like, Tim Duncan was never a flashy player, and you hardly noticed him during the game. But at the end of the game, he got you like 30, 12, and 10. And you're like, how did that happen? You know what I mean?
So, you know, and I mean, like, when you look at how players play and, you know, how they sort of like express their emotions, he was always calm, cool, and collected. He was stoic out there. And I mean, that almost like made me want to watch him less, but his dominance like overshadowed any of that. And you couldn't argue that he was, you know, the epitome of a post player. It's like, where did they go? We need him back. Or we need him teaching, like, cause the game has changed so much. But I think that there was a shift. I don't know, because I'm a little younger, but my understanding was that the Celtics played team basketball, like all 5 guys on the court, just like offense, defense, passing, like, you know, that was almost like the epitome of traditional basketball. And then Jordan came and said, like, he tried to do it by himself. Tried to say like a one-man superstar could change the game. And I think Phil Jackson helped him realize that, like, you kind of still need everybody, but even if it's like more you versus a supporting role. In any case,
don't realize the first 6 years in Jordan's career got nothing. He got nowhere the first 6 years, you know? Okay. So now take us, you're going into your senior year. You're not even playing basketball. Mm-hmm. So what is that year like when you see your guys that were on your team suiting up and you're seeing them in the hallway and you're not playing anymore? What was that like?
I think my relationship kind of took a hit with a few of my friends. Our environment was pretty, I don't want to say toxic. I mean, for me, it was a little toxic. Like, when I was a freshman, like every year our coach would bring in so many freshmen that the upperclassmen would have to try out. And so there were guys that had shown up with me my freshman year who always wanted to play, but like there weren't enough spots on the team for them anymore. So they would spend their whole offseason working out, getting in shape. And so there were some guys that took my spot on the team. I don't know if they felt bad about it, but there had been friends that I took their spot on the team. And so a lot of us had to like sort of just like get over it. You know, I had one friend tell me that, like, he really counted on me to, like, help the team get better. And then quitting on them the senior year was, I don't know, he didn't call me a name or selfish. I could just tell he was, like, ticked off about it. And that's an interesting thing, because up until that point, I had done a lot of things for other people. And that was kind of like my first time making a choice saying, like, I'm doing this for myself. To just not have to go through the stress. Like, that was it. I was just too stressed out to play for that coach another year. And the love that I had for my friends and my teammates wasn't enough to put me through that for another year. So on one hand, I was really relieved to just like be out of that space and out of that environment. Maybe my teammates also wanted to be out of it, but they were willing to deal with it for another year or whatever. So I just, you know, it was awkward. They actually had more success after I left. They made it to the NIT tournament. They played against Virginia, and I really wanted to be a part of that. But, you know, I had to adopt the mentality myself of, you know, I made my choice. I made my bed. I'm not going to live with regrets. I did the best I could. I mean, the day that I stopped playing was the day that I had to lift my leg just to, like, sit down into a car. I'm like, clearly I'm done. But, you know, the other mentality, I didn't have that environment that was just like, oh, no, this is an injury. We can get over it. We can help you rehab. We can help you get better. It was never like, you know, we're trying to develop athletes for the future. It was, you know, you're just playing while you're here. And if you do something after this, great. But, you know, I'm just here to, like, use every ounce of your energy while you're on my team. But yeah, back to your point, like, yeah, if we had that team mentality, it would have been different.
You know, that's the same thing in the military. It's kind of like, you know, all right, we're going to use you. We're going to get every drop of blood, every drop of sweat out of you. And then, you know, we're done. You know, where like your basketball players, you know, even if they make it to the league, I think their career, I think, is like 2.5 years or something like that. So even if you make it to the league, you know, you're 23, 24. Mm-hmm. And everything you've worked for your whole life is over. It's a wrap. And a lot of guys, you know, can't even put two sentences together. So they're not going to be able to have a career like Mark Jackson, where you can move into the booth or something like that. And they're bankrupt, you know, after 2 years in the league. And a lot of it's because, you know, they relied so much on their athletic talent that they didn't, you know, realize that there's a whole person. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, a whole person and like a whole world, like, you know, I recognize that from sports. I guess what I'm getting at is I meet a lot of former athletes who are really struggling with, like, you know, what are the rules of the game outside of sports? Cause it feels like a different world. You know, it's, you go in, you put in hard work, your coaches reward you, or you have a game and you can prove your performance and say, like, I scored this many points, like, clearly, like, I'm a factor or whatever. And yet those rules don't apply to the working world. You know, it's not just like the time you put in. It's like the networking, it's the friendships, it's the relationships, it's you know, sometimes it's the leverage, it's whatever it is. Like, the game isn't always like neat and clean and pretty, but it's way messier than the games that we played for the same levels of recognition. And I mean, whether you're academically prepared for some of those jobs, or if it's a job that doesn't require sort of like, you know, that level of, I mean, this, the tough part is just like, if you do go pro, even semi-pro, like, the money is just sort of easier to get. And it's just what you're used to, and trying to earn money in a different way, it takes a lot. And I've just seen so many people, like, either struggling to get jobs, struggling to keep jobs. And it's like the mentality of, it's like, we also don't want to go back into those environments where our coaches or whoever is like barking orders at us or stressing us out. And our bodies are already just like, oh, this feels, you know, we can get into the science of it, but it's like, when you're stressed out, you release all these hormones into your body and it puts you in fight or flight mode. And like, you want to, like, you know, run, you want to fight, you want to flee, whatever it is, but you're just stuck in this chair. You're just staring at your screen, and like the stress just builds up and it causes inflammation. And, you know, a lot of athletes wind up with hip flexor issues, or a lot of people do, just because we're sitting in chairs all day. Yeah, me too. It's like, I should just get up and we should stretch together right now. But there's so many things that are happening, like, to us when we are stressed, that our bodies are telling us we don't want to be here, or we can't function here, or this is reminding us of something traumatic from our past. And when even that environment's inescapable, then you've got to go somewhere else. And for me, like, you know, it took me 20 years after college to get to the point, but.
Yeah. You know, so what did you, you know, when you get out of college, you know, because for me, like, and I'm going to say this because, and a lot of people look at me a weird way, you know, people ask me who my favorite basketball player of all time is. It's Dennis Rodman, number 91, because he was the guy that he didn't care if he got a point, but if you needed a rebound, if you needed a steal, if you needed to get somebody to hack a shack and get thrown out of the game. He had that dog mentality.
Yeah. And
I think, you know, in business, especially now, or in life in general, you have to, if I started my basketball team, that's the kind of guy I would start out with. Nice. And then I build around him. Because nice. Once you have a dog, you know, once you have somebody that's willing to do whatever he can to win the game, you can build around that. But I think a lot of people, they go for more of the flash, and they don't have any people on their team that have the dog in them.
Yeah.
So talk to us about, you know, especially in corporate world, you need to have, some of us need to have a dog mentality, because, you know, there's like, you know, even in the NBA, there's certain people like Steph Curry that just have that talent. But there's also, you know, people like Udonis Haslam for the Heat. You know, he's been putting work in for 20 years, yeah. and he's still got that dog mentality. So I think sometimes you need the elite players, but sometimes you got to have that dog.
Well, I mean, talking about balance, like personal balance, life balance, basketball balance is crucial. You do have to have that dog mentality. You know, I feel like I had it a little bit on the basketball court because I was more defensive minded than offensive minded. And so I was willing to guard every position from point guard to center. I wanted to shut everybody down, and I wanted my team to help me shut everybody down. So I was always talking on defense. You know, I was a little bit of like the, you know, I wanted to be the emotional motivator at times to get people fired up. I was pretty fired up out there. And in the corporate world, I found that I've had to have that mentality with a smile on my face. Like on the basketball court, you can puff up a little bit and show that like this is where I'm at. That doesn't work in the corporate world. Maybe it does. Maybe it has worked for some people. I think that it might depend on the industries you're in or the people that you're working with. There's a lot of industries and companies and businesses that started off, you know, they're old industries because they were created back in a crazier day where, you know, it was like dog eat dog and business, the business world, it really still is a lot of like dog eat dog. And so it kind of depends on what role you want to play. Are you like those cartoons that we saw, like Tiny Toons back or Looney Tunes back in the day? You had the big dog and he always had like a few little dogs around him. And, you know, that might be like a example of more ego than anything, but it's this approach, this mentality of like the mentality that I wish I had more so as a business person is not caring so much about following the rules. I found that, you know, kind of like the dog mentality on the basketball court is, you know what the rules are, so you push them in every direction you can to see how much you can get away with. And that's a little bit of my perspective on the dog mentality in the corporate world. Like, learn the rules, learn what's right, do the most for your employees and your customers. And, you know, but you have to be a little less timid about doing that. I think that at least me or my generation or people that like are educated on being entrepreneurs, and that's a difference that I've seen. People who are educated on being entrepreneurs find success a lot slower because they're trying to find all these rules to follow. Whereas the real entrepreneurs, the street hustlers or hustlers in general, the people who have just gone out and done it because like that's what their environment sort of taught them to do, they find so much success and they find it a lot faster. And, you know, for me, I take it down to the mentality. Like they were just like, you know, this is a dog eat dog world and I'm going to get mine. And, you know, I just kind of want to do that and help people along the way. But I think I need a little bit more dog in me, given the challenges that I've faced, just trying to bring solutions to the healthcare industry or to a lot of these decision makers who seem to pay less attention to. Maybe that's it. If they're still in that dog mentality, like you kind of need like a mama dog a little bit, like not to bring out slang words. But, you know, I think that right now we're realizing that a lot of the issues we're facing are because we're doing things without any compassion. Like compassion has not been a part of the equation, and we need to incorporate that and figure out how to be dogs with compassion.
Okay, you know, and I get that, but also I'm realizing because for the last year I've been taking a deep dive into entrepreneurship mindset, and you know, for all people that I I follow and are mentoring me, like Mr. John Lee Dumas, Russell Brunson, people like that, you know, they say that you got to, in order to master a skill, you got to put in the work. You got to put in steps, you know, to master a skill, you got to put in your 10,000 hours. And a lot of people, I think, in the younger generations coming up, think, you know, well, I want to start at the top. No, bro, you need to start at junior varsity. Then you need to work up varsity. And then you need to work up to captain. You can't just start out at captain.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's fun looking at these good ideas, like when you're in college or before you have experience. But, you know, when it comes to building a solid foundation and recognizing how much people are a part, are not a part, people are everything. People are what matters more so than a business idea or making money. And it's either about the people you're serving or the people helping you. And so for me, you know, I can't separate the two. I need my people to succeed as much as I do, or else I don't feel like it's success. So yeah, it's a mentality. I'm getting lost in my thoughts because
it was funny, yeah, because this is because you just said, you know, I need my friends to eat. Like I, you know, and I was one of my softball games with my kids the other day, and I was talking to another father. We're talking about music and stuff like that, and I'm like, we're talking about, you know, certain music, and he's like, I bet, you know, I think we're talking about Hot 97, which is a big radio station here, and and he's like, wait a minute, how do you know about Tupac and DMX? I'm like, because that's the music I got in my iPod. Mm-hmm. He's like, what? And yeah, you know, because I'm old school, you know, old school hip hop. And I told him, I said, that's one thing I loved about DMX was, you know, he always said, you know, I'm going to eat and my dogs are going to eat, you know, and bringing it up to, you know, up into, you know, business as of today. The guy that introduced us, you know, Mr. Robert Garcia, the warrior strategist, you know, says, you know, a rising tide lifts all ships.
Yep.
Which is just a white guy's version of DMX saying, I'm going to eat. My dogs are going to eat. Yeah. You know what I mean, so I just wanted, you know, just wanted to give a little shout out to Rob. But, you know, a lot of people don't think, you know, they don't think about the win-win situation where everybody wins. Right. You know, they have, when you become an entrepreneur, well, if I'm winning, somebody has to lose. No, we can all win.
Yeah.
So, you know, please talk about that. Cause like you were just saying, you know, when I eat, my people eat.
Oh, well, I mean, I love DMX. I mean, I could probably quote too many of his songs. And yeah, I mean, it's amazing how somebody who had his life, I almost wrote a movie about DMX cause I read a book about him and all the things that he went through, to even just to develop his lyrics. Like you can see, I mean, that it was a great example of how like your childhood influences your life decisions on and on. Like what he went through, you know, that's, you can hear it in his music. You can hear his life lessons through, you know, every song that he sings. And it's an example of like, you know, what happens when it's the environments. Like, you know, it's so poetic, but to grow, like, this is what happens when poetry grows up, like in those neighborhoods where things are set up the way they're set up. But we were talking about, the question again was,
you know, how in the corporate world, you know, mm-hmm. you can win, oh. win. It doesn't have to be, I win, you lose. You can collaborate and win more and win even more.
What inspired me was that movie, A Beautiful Mind, with John Nash. And so he was an economist at Princeton. I was studying economics at Brown. And his obsession, so to speak, was, you know, there is a mathematical equation where there's an equilibrium. Where, like, if you've seen the movie, he's basically, like, following a group of pigeons, eating bird seed, like, and he's just, like, sprinting around them, just like trying to figure out like what is the explanation for like how do all these birds eat together. And I don't know how much he actually found it, but I was inspired. I was like, there is an equilibrium. And I'm one of those people who kind of sees things as one extreme or the other. Like, this is the far left, this is the far right, whatever the topic is. And the concept of equilibrium was something that I kept wanting, like work-life balance. Like, what is that? And then it was, and then when it became a matter of like stress, it was like, you know, how am I sort of balancing my emotions? And then recognizing that there's so many emotional spectrums to balance. And that is, you know, essentially what led me to this concept of like, you know, I guess statistically or comparatively, like, you know, I should have been potentially more happy with where I was. You know, I had a job on Wall Street and I was making, you know, good money, but, you know, I was still trying to climb that corporate ladder. And the more I tried to climb, the more times I kept hitting my head on that glass ceiling. And that's, and I was coming from this perspective of like, I've had the lowest job on the totem pole. I've seen and I've studied what the top level decision makers are trying to come up with. And despite, you know, wanting to, and the thing was, I was making suggestions at work. You know, one job I had is like, oh, we could do this more efficiently. Another job I had is like, oh, if we rearrange these things or introduce this new, you know, line item or this new business opportunity, there's so much that we could do. And I don't know if my suggestions were like intimidating or daunting or stressful, but I recognize that nobody else was trying to really reach that equilibrium. Nobody was trying to balance out, like, you know, how we could pay the lower end like more, or how we could subsidize things to keep people feeling more on an even playing field. But they just weren't receptive. The decision makers really didn't seem to want to change anything that could, you know, tweak what could, you know, if they have to give something up in order for somebody else to get something. And, you know, economically, you know, strategically, there's just a lot of ways around that. We don't have to take that approach. It's just, you know, how much do we want to think about other ways to do things to be more cost effective for everybody?
So, okay, now we're going to talk about your app, which I use every day, sometimes 2 to 3 times a day. It's probably one of my favorite apps. It's except like on my phone, it's like right up in the left-hand corner. It's like, so I'm always on it. So, now talk to us, because, you know, in the tech world, you know, talk about making apps. And then like when we talked the last time and you talked about the app, you were giving it away for free. Yeah. And, you know, you talk to anybody that's, you know, a tech, anybody in tech, they're like, you're going to do what? You know, why would I invent something I can to give away for free? So talk about your app a little bit and talk about why you developed your app.
Sure. So I guess to start was, as I'm going through life and working on Wall Street and looking to like rise to the top and sort of just dealing with stress, my way of dealing with stress was to just sort of bottle it in. You know, whether a coach is yelling at me or whether I disagreed or whether nobody listened to my ideas, you know, I wasn't really expressing my disappointment or frustration. So I would keep it all in. And it wasn't until I was like 30 when my back broke. Like I was doing great at work. I was getting married. I had written a book and I was feeling on top of the world. And so I'm training for like this, you know, a half marathon just to get in shape for my wedding. And my back broke. And I figured it was because, you know, my high school basketball court that I played 4 years on was concrete. And that it was just like wear and tear. And that's what the doctors told me. But then they didn't give me surgery. They didn't, like, you know, I guess at the time they said they would have had to fuse my discs unless I wanted to like go to Germany for some surgery that I couldn't afford really. And so I wound and they gave me like the physical therapy really wasn't like changing the game enough. But we were exploring things. And, you know, the other scenario was, my dad had died from cancer in 2010. So I think at this point it had been 10 years since he had passed. I had my own frustrations with the healthcare industry from my dad's experience. And then when I went there and asked for help and I really wasn't getting it, I kind of reached a point where I felt like I needed to save myself if anything good was going to happen. And through that process, I learned about, I just Googled, like, how do I make the discs in my back, like, regrow? And what are my options? And I kept finding results around sound and vibration. And then I started seeing all these quotes and like all these people were talking about, like Einstein and Tesla that had a lot of good quotes around like numbers and frequencies and vibration. And so I kept exploring, and I had studied music in high school, middle school. So I mean, I played the saxophone, and I was good enough to get in the jazz band and concert and all that. But I didn't know everything. So it was a lot of revisiting, you know, what is music and what is sound. And then I came across binaural beats. And when I tried that for the first time, I felt my mind just go to another place. Like, I went from being, you know, at work or whatever to like completely calm, completely relaxed at work. And then I was like, I need this. I need this to like help me get through these like really challenging days and all these challenging moments. And I was like, all right, but I don't know what I'm putting into myself. Like, I need to understand like how these really work. And that's when I learned about the solfeggio scale. And in band class in South Carolina, like after our concert was over, like we still had another like week of school. And so our teacher would give us the Sound of Music to watch every year. For 7 straight years, I watched the Sound of Music right before Christmas break. And the big song in that movie is Do, Re, Mi, Fa, Sol, La, Ti. Do, a deer, female deer. I'm not going to sing it for everybody. But, you know, that's the solfeggio scale. And the significance that I found through my research was that monks have been using this for thousands of years, just like humming each of those notes, because each note vibrates at a different part of our body. And as I'm doing this research, I'm realizing that, you know, there's the Eastern explanation for this and the Western explanation. And on the West, they talk about the endocrine system and the glands that we have in our endocrine system and how they release these hormones that happen when we get stressed or when we get relaxed. And I realized that everything that they're talking about here with the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system is like the physical explanation for the energy story that they're telling in the East about chakras and meridians and acupuncture and all these sort of ancient practices. And so I started to sort of understand and try to bridge that gap to say, like, all right, are we really talking about the same thing? Because if we are, then we've got a lot of like relevant information to use that could present another way to heal people. And so, you know, at first I was using other binaural beat generators. I was like typing out things and doing calculations on the go. It's like, this combination should have this effect. And, you know, I shared it with other people and they said that they were having positive experiences. So that got the ball rolling to say, I think we've got something here. It does seem to be working. And now, you know, we raised some money. Enough to like launch a proof of concept. You know, for any entrepreneurs that are watching this show, the mistake that I made was not monetizing early on. So why is the app free? When I first came out with the app, the education that I had was show a proof of concept. And I was really just trying to prove that sound could have a healing effect. And once I proved that, my goal was to raise money so that way people could, so we can enhance the experience and make it something that could be more monetizable. So at first it was just proving it. And now I realize, or at least I hope the entrepreneurial education books are telling people to monetize as early as you can in order to, you know, dodge this particular hurdle that I'm in. Now the other
side, talking a little bit about entrepreneurial, now I've taken a deep dive for the last 3 years in entrepreneurship, and I didn't know nothing. But you know, being in Rob's group, I've taken his courses, the DIY courses. And one thing I've learned that, like you're talking about, you know, why some things are free. Some of the apps that we use are free. Like I use Waze, mm-hmm. and you know, they're free, mm-hmm. but you know, they're getting paid, because they're using monetization, you know, they're getting companies to sponsor them and stuff like that. So, but I think you're right you know, now you're starting to think, wait a minute, you know, I can't be doing this for free forever.
Right.
Eventually, right. You have to monetize, you know, because like even we say in, you know, I've been in recovery 33 years, you know, I can't pour from an empty cup. So if I'm broke, I can't help you.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, eventually you're going to have to start bringing some money in it. So I think it's a great time to actually start thinking about and acting upon the monetization of your app.
Yeah. And, you know, it's, we're exploring that 100%. Because even if you're ever trying to get an investor, like nowadays, you know, investors are most appeal or most interested in companies that are already generating revenue, and then they can invest to help you generate more revenue. I spent a few years like trying to just share that this app was working and that it could help with stress and anxiety and, you know, insomnia and depression and all these different things it can help with. And, you know, I took it first to hospitals because I noticed that nurses were going through burnout. I also realized that it was my burnout that led me to my back pain, my injuries, and like the choices that I was making. And, you know, all the those experiences being in that pain ultimately led to me like getting fired because I wasn't concentrating at work. Everything out of my mouth was a complaint because I was just already in pain, like just sitting there, standing there, walking there, sleeping in the morning. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't spend as much time in bed. Because the longer I slept, the more my back would hurt the next morning. So I started shortening my sleep cycles and it was making me more irritable, even though I didn't realize it. Combined with the pharmaceuticals that the doctors were prescribing, I just became a bitter, grumpy person. And so, I went to nurses. That was my burnout. I recognized that. I tried to help nurses, but they were telling me that they can't use it unless it's FDA approved, or they can't give it to patients unless it's FDA approved. And then I went to, you know, venture capitalists to raise money to prove this stuff on a clinical level. But all along the way, or we get to that point, the venture capitalist is like, oh, that's great. You're helping people. How much money are you making? And I tell them zero. And they're like, sorry, we can't invest. So, you know, trying to figure out how to heal people and then having, but in a way they haven't experienced before, and then have them pay for it. It felt like a big ask. And even the results were showing that we would make the app cost $1 and we'd get a few downloads. And then we make the app free and we would get 1,000 downloads. And so that was kind of our recipe for, and we're getting advice suggesting that you build an audience, try to get to 1 million people. And then like, you know, that'll at least open up advertising, like passive advertising or creative advertising, whatever direction we want to go. But it always seemed like it was that million, you know, download threshold that we're hovering around like 36,000 downloads. Our retention rates are high. Our efficacy rates are above 80%. So we have to use what we have, talking about like, you know, pouring from an empty cup. I have used all levels of like spiritual sort of connection and trying to understand sort of like why I'm doing this and why it's important and recognizing the help that I'm providing, like that gives me the energy to sort of keep going. But yeah, when it comes to monetizing, we have to do it to be sustainable. And, you know, coming up with sustainable business models is something else that we've done. We figured out how to get help and support from people sort of through like shared equity models. Whereas like, if you're working on this project with me, I'm going to share this equity with you. So we've got kind of like it to your point, we've got a couple of small projects where we're coming out with the fashion line to help with our branding. We're working with researchers to validate our approach. We're looking to bring developers, but in each of these little pockets, like everybody, we're tracking their contributions. So when we do make money or we can, you know, sort of validate the value of our equity, then everybody's going to feel like their contributions are reflective. Like my percentage is going to be, you know, as transparent as somebody else's percentage. So ultimately, we have to find ways to be sustainable. We have to find ways to contribute. We're exploring like a donation based model. But I'm also here to learn from you. I mean, you know, we recognize like that I want to help, that people need help, and that this is a resource that doesn't need to cost a lot of money to be effective. But how do you support the business that's doing all that?
You know, for me, like I said, I love my app. I have it, like I said, it's up in the left corner of my phone. So before I go to bed at night, I'll use it in the morning because one of my friends, John McCaskill, he's a Navy SEAL commander. He wrote the book Embrace the Suck. You know, he talks about how your morning ritual and your evening rituals will set your day up for either success or failure. So for the first 15 minutes, and I'll touch my phone because I'll click your app, but I won't go on to Facebook. I won't check messages. I won't any social media, any news. And I find that using your app and also, you know, that first 15 minutes and the last 15 minutes of my day using that app has really turned my whole life around. So please talk about that, you know, how your daily rituals using the app, how they can help veterans, first responders, or really anybody struggling with anxiety, depression, pain, insomnia. So talk to us about the actual use of the app.
Sure. At its core, Euphoria is an intention generating machine. The thing is, the behavior pattern that I recognized in myself and a lot of people who are dealing with chronic issues is that it's a perspective and it's a mentality that you have, sort of like a habit of thinking a certain way. Like if you wake up in the morning saying like today's going to suck, then today's going to suck. If you wake up going to bed saying like today sucked, then today sucked. I've learned sort of in a variety of ways, even from my wife, like who she's really good at silver lining. And it's not really that like this is a bad situation that needs a silver line. It's that there is a wonderful experience to be had if that's your perspective. And so she and I could have the same experience. And for years, like, I'm just like, well, I'm glad you had fun. I did not. But it was more of that, you know, me reaching a place or a perspective or recognizing that I could have a perspective that there is so much good stuff happening and I'm just focusing on the negative. And so for me, and the reason I created Euphoria and the way that it works, it's about setting that intention to have the mindset that you want, the state of mind that you want to be in, or that you would prefer to be in. And so if you know that you're in a negative state, you're in a pessimistic state, or you're feeling anxious, just knowing that there is another mindset to get into, like that is really about setting an intention. And so Euphoria has a long list of intentions that you can create. We want to make it a little simpler in the future. So, you know, for people who are very sort of in touch with the emotions that they might want to have or the emotions that they don't want to have, it can be more intuitive to use the app to say like, I want to feel calm while I boost my confidence and like in the activity set that I'm doing while I am exercising or while I'm meditating. So ultimately, the idea is for you to set the intention and to let the binaural beats and the sound waves hold that intention for you. Now, there's a lot of science and theory that I can refer to when it says like this frequency, it resonates with this part of the body. It can hit, you know, we have acupressure points in our ear the same way we have pressure points all over our body, the same way we have reflexology on our feet. So there's so many different places on your body to deal with the same issue, whether it's an organ or a gland. But all of that happens because of the experiences that we have that shape the directions our neurons decide to connect dots. And so regardless of the emotional state or the sound wave, like really it all comes down to knowing that you have a choice in every moment. And what happens is as we get older, our subconscious handles most of these things automatically. And we just go ahead and we do whatever we've always done, or we do whatever we learned how to do. And when you become a parent, like I realized how much of my dad skills or parenting skills were a 100% reflection of the environment that I grew up in. And I'm grateful for the environment I grew up in. It's that I kind of want my son to grow up in an even better one. And so what can I do to make his environment better? I can be calmer. I can be more understanding. I can listen. I can be more patient. And getting to that place was not easy. Still not easy. Like you get to the point where you feel your body like building up. You feel that, like that energy building and that anxiety building. Like I'll feel, you know, my chest get tighter. And when I feel it, that's when I know, like, oh, I've got a lot of negative thoughts happening. Like I can feel it's about to come out of my mouth right now. But if I take any number of steps or activities, whether it's taking a breath or counting to 10 or closing my eyes or walking away, all those are the same as like turning on my app and saying like, I need something that's going to keep me in a calm place or keep me where I want to be. So that way I can enjoy whatever environment I'm in, no matter what the situation is. I know that I am still me and I'm in control of however I respond to this environment. And the more I've done that, the more I've enjoyed my experiences more. And I've been more open to the people and the situation. And it's like I reached a mentality even just yesterday that it's like I never want to get below this mentality. And so each time that something might have triggered me, I recognize it's like, nope, I want to be here. How can I get here?
You know, I was talking to somebody last week about your app, and they were asking me, well, why would I listen to it? And I said, listen, I said, if we're about to hit the gym and you have your iPhone and you got your ear pods on, me, if I want to get hyped up, I'm going to put X on. I'm going to put Tupac. I'm going to put Metallica or Five Finger Death Punch. I'm not going to put Yanni music. You know, I'm not going to put relaxation music if I want to go bench 300 pounds.
Sure.
And I also, if I'm at night, if I'm going to relax, I'm not going to put on DMX music or Five Finger Death Punch before I go to bed. And sure. I think it's the same thing. It's just, you know, you're just explaining it in different words. Now, yeah. How do you feel when you watch the commercials with LeBron James and his app? You know, and aren't you like, man, we're along the same plane? You know, we're trying to hit the same people.
Yeah, I want to come back to your first one. I mean, I might need you to remind me of it. With LeBron, I had reached out to LeBron, like, you know, trying to like pump up euphoria on social media. And at the time I sent it out, I had seen him saying that LeBron doesn't download apps. He doesn't look at apps. So I'm like, all right, well, he might not be an ally. But then I did see his commercial on Calm. And, you know, I understood the game. Like, Calm is further along. They are more fully funded. They did get, you know, funding to sort of push this marketing approach. And it works. And I think that LeBron has introduced so many more people to the benefits of mindfulness and meditation beyond just the Calm app. And so I'm grateful that he's out there doing that. I personally would love to see lots of athletes and professionals and all sorts of brand ambassadors for Euphoria. Like, we're kind of trying to set it up to where everybody can be a brand ambassador for Euphoria and get compensated for it. And so ultimately, yeah, would you remind me what the first part of your question was? Because I had a good answer for that one, too.
No, you know, I was just talking about, you know, like, when I go to the gym I'm put on some thumping music, but when I go to bed, I don't want DMX going on in my head when I'm trying to go to bed.
That is just it. You know, it's a combination of like the rhythm of the song, like, you know, how intense is the beat? How quick is the beat? You know, if it's something that is generally like high intensity, that's what it's designed to do, is to get you hype. In the same way, like slow music has slower beats, slower melodies, and it slows you down. So again, it's like two ways of looking at frequencies. And, it's not the deepest science, but, you know, frequency just in terms of like how quickly do things happen? You know, when you're sleeping, your brain waves are moving very slow. And that's why you feel relaxed, and your other parts of your body respond to those slower vibrations. And the fight or flight, you know, on some level is a little bit higher frequency and a little more intense. And so, you know, when you're going to the gym, you want to get hype, you get the right music on, or going to sleep. That's what Euphoria does. Like, you're picking a combination that says like, get me hype, or put me to sleep, or put me into meditation, or help me relax, or help me focus. Like, there's like everything you do, there's a state of mind associated with it. And we could use a Spotify playlist to dictate your day. the benefit of euphoria is more along the lines of, I want to listen to my music anyway. I've got podcasts to listen to, you know, but I want to be in the right frame of mind when I do it. So you can turn on euphoria, create the beat that you want to hear, and then go listen to your music and sort of enhance your workout. Like there's there's a couple of settings there, like vitality or rejuvenation. Like I've enjoyed having longer workouts, going on longer bike rides when I would turn rejuvenation on while I'm exercising. So all the wear and tear that your body is probably going through, you can heal that while you're exercising, or you can heal it when you're done with your exercise. So it's part of what we're trying to do is show all the different scenarios that euphoria can play in the background and enhance whatever it is that you want to go to or get to. Because when the intention is like, I want to get good at this, better at this, faster at this, like recover, you know, quicker at this, like vibration is already playing a part of what we're going through. But, you know, if you live in a certain place where you're dealing with noise pollution, or you got noisy neighbors, or, you know, or it's a high traffic area, like we're surrounded by vibrations all the time. That's why, you know, the monks go live in the mountains, in the woods, where the vibrations are nature. It's trees, it's birds, it's wind, versus like concrete and cars and smog. And so whatever end of the spectrum you live on, it's knowing that you can add more of whatever vibration you want to that situation. You can listen to binaural beats, or you can buy a plant, or you can buy a painting with certain colors in it that are going to give you the vibes that you need. Everything that we go through in life kind of shifts. You know, for me, like I have a 7-point scale of positive and negative. So, you know, depending on what's been driving your negativity, there are going to be certain things that can like help you with that positivity. And so like, I'm always available. Like if somebody wants to have a conversation saying like, this is exactly what stressed me out, I can help recommend, you know, a binaural beat combination for that. You know, people have asked, you know, I've got a cold, or I've got insomnia, or I want to recover better. I've had military vets and mother-in-laws, they're all just like, you know, help me with something. And there's a direction I can help guide them through euphoria to say, you know, try this and see how it goes.
So now, you know, like before I come on every time, every episode I come on, you know, I put on Eminem, Lose Yourself, and I hear, dun, 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 and I'm getting, you know, I'm hyped and I'm excited. Yeah. But, you know, but now if I didn't do that and I come on and it'd be like, hey guys, yeah, welcome to another episode. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You for everybody, I think eventually, if to get hyped up, you have your own kind of entrance music. Like I'm a big WWE guy, so nice. You know, Lose Yourself, that's my entrance music. Even when I talk on stage, that's my entrance music. So, but
that's epic. I would do the same. I love Eminem.
So tell us about your one or two. You don't have to name them. Two of your biggest success stories using your app.
For me personally. Okay, sure. So I'd say the first story that comes to mind was I had launched the app in 2017, and I learned about this new organization called Transformative Technology. And it was a great group because I found there were like 2,000 other people around the world who are like me, people who had overcome their own personal issues in order to, you know, and recognize that we have something new to introduce to the healthcare space or another way to help people take care of themselves. And so it was a great group of people, but they needed me to do a pitch competition. And I have struggled with, stage fright since I was a kid. When I was maybe 5 years old, I was just in South Carolina. These people asked me to rap. And because I told them I was from Jersey, they was like, oh, you can rap, right? I'm like, yeah, no, I didn't know what they were asking.
What do they think? You were Tretch?
I was gonna hit hot. But ultimately it was like they handed me a microphone, they started playing music. I was shook and everybody just started laughing. It happened later again in life. Like, so I just stopped enjoying like being on stage or even like sharing ideas because I just really was avoiding people laughing at me. And I would say that for that competition, I had to overcome a lot to talk about, you know, this subject, which was still like very new. There were very few people talking about sound. And so I was nervous. I was really nervous. And, you know, I listened to binaural beats all day. I was listening to it all the way up. I was ignoring like instructions because I needed, like, I was just cranking up like euphoria. And I even watched another person in the competition just quit right before she got on stage. It was like, I knew the pressure she was feeling. And I, like everything in life, you know, it's sometimes you just got to like lower your head and go. And I don't think that if I didn't have euphoria, I would not, one, I wouldn't have been asked to be on that stage, but two, I wouldn't have been able to like overcome all that anxiety just to force myself onto the stage.
How about a customer? What kind of people, what kind of customer experience have you received? What kind of feedback?
We've gotten a lot of feedback. Everything from, you know, I have anxiety as I commute to work, or anxiety like before I talk to my boss or whatever. People have found a lot of success with just having a tool to help them calm down with their anxiety. And there's a lot of extreme levels of it. And so it could be a combination of like, how long do you listen to it? How often do you listen to it? You know, there's a dozen different ways that we can approach anxiety just through euphoria. And so if you're finding what you're looking for, ultimately people have said that, yes, I use it for anxiety. I've used it for insomnia because there's binaural beats. It's essentially just getting your brain to vibrate at the same level that it would if you were sleeping. And so that's what these binaural beats are doing. If I didn't explain it, is that, you know, when you're asleep, your brain is vibrating like between like around 1 hertz, like just barely beating. Whereas like the music you listen to is probably more at like, you've heard of 528 hertz. Like that's a healing frequency. And so when you're sleeping, that's like way below one. So in any case, we've had success there. The biggest one was my first patient, or not even a patient, but the first person to come to me was like, I need this. I know what you're doing. I know that it can work, but I need it specifically to deal with my chemotherapy. Like I'm in a lot of pain. I feel really sick. I'm really groggy. I don't like my mentality after or during. And so I came up with a whole playlist for her, to help her deal with all the things that she was talking about. So whatever the issue was, here's a binaural beat for that. Here's a binaural beat for that. And she got through her chemotherapy. And then when she was going through her, there's a better word for it, but you know, the surgery that they go through to augment, I guess, afterwards.
Yeah.
She needed euphoria again for pain management. And I gave her again, another playlist of suggestions. And, you know, it was a woman that, you know, was a friend. I think she worked with somebody in my family. And so when I was able to get her feedback, you know, she recommended it to the next woman that she knew that was going through those same issues, between like breast cancer and breast surgery. So, you know, that was validating. I helped a psychologist's son once who was dealing with, you know, depression and self-harm. And I built him a playlist. And, you know, he told me that I was a big part of helping his son like bounce back from that, you know, even faster than they expected. And so those are the stories that keep me in the game, even when I'm not making any money, is that, you know, this is working. It is helping. And, you know, the money will come exactly when it needs to. But ultimately, it's about proving that sound can heal. And I feel like we've done that. So now let's have some more fun with it.
So how do we find you? How do we find the app? How do we support your mission?
Well, my mission, if phrasing it that way, I'm putting a link in the chat. So you can download the app. It's only on iOS. And, you know, I do want it on Android. And so that is one very important mission. And that's a mission I've been on since 2017. It's like, will anybody help me raise the money? So that way we can get this on Android to help more people. My real mission. Oh, and you can also find. So there's the website, www.euphoriaapp.com. So that's the letter U, the number 4, the letter E, the letter A for euphoria. And then app is app.com. I'm on LinkedIn. You know, anybody's welcome to reach out to me on LinkedIn. I love the conversations there, and they always lead to, you know, us having, you know, more Zooms and such. So you can get in touch with me that way. But ultimately, my goal is world peace through inner peace. it's my sort of feeling that, you know, if people have the room, the time, the space to do the self-exploration, to sort of recognize when, you know, I want to be hype for this thing, or I want to be chill for this thing, or recognize that I'm anxious because I want to be experiencing something in a certain way, but all these other factors are messing with that. And so my goal is for everybody, to just give everybody else a space to self-explore, to understand sort of what they're going through. Because when more people, and like, this is like me and my sister, we're like those siblings that just butted heads our whole lives until we decided to just stop butting heads and like start giving each other like advice and suggestions. And this is what's working for me, and what's working for her is now helping me too. So, you know, we were able to build another perspective, to take a better approach. And now we have a lot more personal inner peace, and a lot less things are driving us nuts. So our relationship has grown. And I think that, you know, that's just a microcosm for everybody else. I think that when everybody gets to that place where they feel their own balance and they're not responding to, you know, old triggers, they can make healthier choices for themselves, the people around them, their businesses or companies, and that grows to communities and it grows to countries. So, you know, spreading the word on the need for personal like peace and balance. And if I need a t-shirt that says, or maybe your t-shirt's like, you know, today I decide, you know, and whatever, you know, that decision is, people make their choices. And if you see somebody wearing that shirt, like, let them decide themselves. I need to get those t-shirts for my kids, because, you know, I honestly feel they're coming from a healthier perspective than whatever it is like my 40 years on this planet is trying to push them towards. Like, you know, I'll tell them what I can, but I think that it comes to for everybody, it's discernment. You've got to choose what works for you. It's about the story that's in your head. So, you know, there's so many people you can go to augment that story, and, you know, experience it for yourself. Recognize that when you think about the positive things and then you have those positive experiences, like, that's the momentum to build off of. So give people space and recognize the benefits of just, you know, taking care of yourself, finding out what makes you happy, and pursuing that, you know, in a healthy way.
I love it, guys. You know, thank you for everybody that's hung on and hanging out with us. If you guys want, leave a comment about are you struggling with anxiety? Are you struggling with depression? Are you struggling with sleeplessness? Because I'm sure my brother Brandon will get back to you and maybe even, you know, tell you, you know, which to use in the app. So, you know, leave that in the comment below. Make sure that you subscribe. Hit that subscribe, you know, make sure you mash that subscribe button. And Brandon, I just want to say thank you so much. I'm so grateful for your friendship. I'm so grateful for your app, because I think it's actually literally has saved my life. So so if you ever need somebody as somebody that's going to endorse your product, just because you gave me the product, no money ever asked, I'm willing to be that guy.
Richard, I'm grateful for you. I mean, that's wonderful to hear. I've watched, from what I've learned from our short conversations to how much more we're going to learn about each other, you know, you're inspiring me as well. And for you to make that comment is like, you know, I might start crying in a second. But ultimately, you know, we're both here to help as many people as we can, and we have to do that together. So I'm glad and grateful that I get to do that with you. I've got more to learn, and we're going to watch each other grow. So it's going to be fun.
I love it, guys. And, you know, I always end with Oprah Winfrey's quote, the best way to help yourself is to help others. And that's what this whole show is about. So thank you for being a part of my journey. Thank you for letting me be a part of your journey. And guys, I'm going on vacation for the next couple of days to spend some time with my bride in Vegas. Who knows? We might, you know, get remarried by Elvis. But I just wanted to say, guys, you know, make sure that you're loving on the ones that are in your life, and really don't really worry about the people that are not in your inner circle, because those are the ones that really matter. Brandon, I just want to say thank you, brother. I want to thank our sponsors, guys. Like, oh, I forgot. If you pick up my book, A Hero's Journey from Darkness to Light, and you're a business owner, if you get my book for $11, I will get you on this show. I will promote your business to up to 1.4 million people. which is a $997 to spend a book on. The book is $11, and 22% of that money goes to help end veteran homelessness and also veteran suicide. So it's a win-win situation. And also, guys, if you love coffee, make sure you pick up Soldier Girl Coffee. You'll love it because it kicks ass. And it also helps make you mellow at the same time. So, guys, I love you. Remember, vertical momentum. The only way to go is but up. Love you guys. And I'll catch you next week.